He looks like anyone else you'd pass on the street.
Give me your money now, sucker.
Except for one thing.
You want my money? Huh? Is this what you want?
He has a slight attitude.
No problem.
Paramount Pictures presents international Kenpo star, Jeff Speakman.
Should be more respectful of our organization.
Is there a problem here?
Yeah.
Guess so.
Hey, Terminator, I don't know where you came from, but you better go back. Those guys are golden fists. You're a dead man.
A tragedy he could not prevent.
Kim!
It's a signature execution. We've seen it before.
Leads him into a forbidden world with nothing to rely on but his own lethal skills.
Who killed Kim?
You cannot handle this by yourself.
Who said it never hurt to ask?
Everybody in Koreatown knows Young killed Kim, Dick. Tracy.
Now, we are ready.
Young and I have some unfinished business. I will finish it.
He has no gun. No fear.
Are you faster than a speeding bullet?
No equal.
No problem.
In his explosive motion picture debut, Jeff Speakman is the perfect weapon.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the most glorious of events, the Movie Mavericks Podcast. This outstanding program is hosted by two fine gentlemen, Jason and Trevor. Now make it so.
MovieMavericks.com.
Hey now, everybody, welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast. I am Trevor Anderson. I'll send you over to Jason Rufio Rugard. He will tell us what we're talking about today.
We are talking about that special movie, The Perfect Weapon. Special because this was a pretty big movie to me when I was 12 years old and this was premiering in theaters.
So likewise, it's special to everyone.
Yeah, it's really, like you said, Rufio there, who we'll talk about, the actor
Rufio.
From Hook, making only his second motion picture appearance in a major film in 1991. But nonetheless, this was a big movie to me. I remember seeing the poster for this in the lobby of the local theater when I was about 11 years old, going on 12, and really just being in kind of awe of it. Because 1991, this era between 1988 and 1992 would maybe be the ending point, 93 specifically. But 91 was, the high point of these martial arts films, with Seagal having a good year, Van Damme having a good year, and The Perfect Weapon premiering in March. Only doing about $30 million adjusted, which is pretty much on average of the average Jason Statham movie today. So not a big hit. Easy to see why this was never sequelized and Speakman didn't really get a chance again, possibly, right?
Yeah. It's not very good.
But they surround him with interesting people on this movie. This was produced by Paramount, so this was given the big push, if you will, by them. This it was number 6th in the rankings. It was premiered in 1,200 theaters, so behind things like The Hard Way and Class Action and things like that. Silence of the Lambs was number 1 in the country the day it premiered. But it was given a push, nonetheless, into 1,200 theaters, which is significant. Russell Carpenter, who had done some work with James Cameron, was the DP. This thing has a nice look to it from a visual standpoint, but it also looks awfully cheap, right? They cheaped out here a little bit. Doesn't this look like the back lot of somewhere?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I'd agree on both those counts. But to be fair, the producer, right, and director here had gotten away with cheapness before, both in Bloodsport and Kickboxer prior to this film, right? Even Death Warrant as well, to some degree. So I don't know. This probably was a bet worth taking, right?
Especially with Speakman, who I think had the looks and the charisma to really be not just the martial arts leading man, but having kind of a Mel Gibson career, I always thought. He had a Mel Gibson quality to him. I could have even seen him as Riggs.
He's such a likable on-screen presence.
Yeah, he's very affable. I mean, you just immediately see he's a good guy. I couldn't ever see him definitely. Playing a bad character.
And it's something that I might agree with you is a little bit unfair about this movie, because you do feel that the rush of what they're shooting here, it just feels very rushed. And a lot of his dialogue, not only his, but a lot of the actors' deliveries feel rushed and feel very flat. And oftentimes no one seems very in the moment, you know, as if there's really no time given to them to be able to, I don't know, try to create something to grab onto to pull themselves into the movie a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know what the turnaround time was production-wise on this, but I would agree with you that things feel hurried, especially the running time. It's very short. This movie is maybe 85 minutes long, and there's even a long ending title sequence, which really tacks on some time, and it doesn't help with the long running time. But regardless, the sequel that never materialized from this, and I'm taking this from a quote that Speakman gave to the Action Elite website back in 2015, he suggests that the origin script for Speed was originally being worked on with him in the lead. It was a little bit different and hadn't completely found its way, but he was saying that they were prepping him at Fox for The Perfect Weapon 2, which was going to be about a bomb on a bus. What do you think about that?
I'm not even sure if I buy that.
No, you're not buying it?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, there may have been a movie similar to that, but I mean, obviously that wasn't Speed. Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, is that just an idea and a name? So something that opens the doors to try to get a movie greenlit?
Or is that something that was pitched in a bunch of ideas?
Serious? Yeah, it does. I don't know. The Perfect Weapon 2, and it was about a bomb on a bus, and he was going to, I mean, it was basically Speed. That almost doesn't even make any sense.
I mean, it could be if you look at the beginning part of Speed with Daniels and Keanu Reeves, and if they have just expanded that a little bit more, maybe, and I could see something like that. You know, if he was,
it would have to have been very different.
Well, of course. I mean, the movie was worked on substantially to become Speed. I'm sure went through a lot of rewrite processes.
Well, but just said, I mean, the basis for the movie still is the bomb on a bus. I don't know.
So who knows?
How different could it have been, right? I don't know.
Well, with Speakman, it could have been a lot fucking different. I'll say that. It wouldn't have been $100 million grosser. We wouldn't have got a part two. But Speakman, either fairly or unfairly, depending on how you look at this film, was only given one other shot at getting a film to the big screen. He had a lengthy career and still does have some sort of recognition as an action star, but mostly in B-movie, straight-to-DVD, HBO premieres in its time. But he was in Street Night, released by Cannon Films, one of their last – virtually their last theatrical release, if not their last together, 93. And that barely made – I think it had like 300 screens it made it on. And it adjusted it about $2 million. So it still – he attracted a fan base, but that's a tough one to get through too. Have you seen that one recently?
I have not.
I got it on videotape. I used to have it on a Laserdisc. You can barely find the fucker.
Yeah, I have it on VHS.
Yeah. So do I, huh? There's two of us. Who'd have thought we're doing a podcast on Speak and we both own his follow-up on VHS?
I got it.
Fucking nerds. But whatever. Moving on from that little tidbit. I think that he could have had a longer career. I don't think this movie should have been the end-all be-all for him, especially with the Paramount deal, because I thought he had a three-picture deal with Paramount. He says that there was a changing of the guard, once again, from this interview he gave to the Action Elite. He says there was a changing of the guard at Paramount. The brass changed, and then the new regime didn't want to take on projects that the old regime had taken on, and they were trying to get it more towards a respectable, quote-unquote respectable films, and not these silly martial arts films. And if you think back on it, Paramount really didn't take their foot into the action genre. Some Harrison Ford stuff, but they never had an action hero that was locked down to them. They had Cruise pretty much under contract. If you think about it, most of his films were under that shingle, but Schwarzenegger didn't do a lot of films at Paramount. Neither did Stallone, neither Van Damme, or Seagal for that fact. So it's strange that they dabbled in it here and said, no, enough is enough for us with one and done.
Well, you look at the result. I can kind of understand.
I'm sure it was the bastard child though at the time of the studio.
Maybe. It's just cheap, really, is in all honesty. If they had maybe spent a little bit more money on it and given Speakman a little bit more time to, I don't know. He doesn't even really get a chance to show off his martial arts skill, I felt like, in this movie, to the degree that a lot of the others that had even come before him at this point had been able to, right? I mean, Van Damme really got to show off all of his moves and stuff in his beginning films. And here, Speakman just kind of, I don't know, it's so cheap, he doesn't really get a shot.
I see what you're saying. I'll agree with you on that, because I would say that Seagal's first film, Above the Law, has a certain glossy element to it. So he doesn't necessarily need to show off the fighting so much, because they were building him mythically. Andrew Davis is so good in that film as a director, and using him and Pam Grier to build a character and a real movie around him, that it was important that he did that. And Bloodsport is so cheaply made, but Van Damme is so athletically gifted.
It's such a great action movie, Bloodsport. I mean, and people fight constantly, and the choreography is great. And
the score.
And it's such a well-directed film as well, you know.
Yeah, editing is great, direction's great, but I would say The Perfect Weapon is somewhere in between those two as a debut film. It's kind of got a glossy studio feel, and it's sort of trying
really,
to show him
it,
fighting.
It really
and,
doesn't do either of those. Oh, there are moments in this movie, there are shots and moments in this movie where it's just clear that they're just on the sidewalk, just grabbing a shot real quick, and it's just two guys just spewing out lines, you know. It's Jeff Speakman and Rufio just saying some stuff, and that's it, you know, time filler. And that's a lot of this movie, unfortunately.
Let's take a quick break and listen to Jeff Speakman talk about his art and this film in his own words.
Tempo is my life. Tempo, it isn't tied to a historical master. It's only tied to the reality that we live in. It really is the science of street fighting. I was a gymnast when I was very young, and then I went on to be a springboard diver in high school and did very well with that. And then it was really my fascination with the old television show Kung Fu, David Carradine show. When they would have the flashbacks when he was like a little kid, and they'd go back to the temple and you see the old men moving around, and I was so taken by that, I really wanted to study karate just to learn form and motion and function. The Perfect Weapon really is the first major feature film to utilize pure Kempo, and really to have Kempo expressed the way that Ed Parker would like it. There have been people here and there that have done it. Of course, as you know, Bruce Lee studied with Ed Parker for quite some time and was heavily influenced by Kempo. But this is really the first time that pure Kempo is coming on film.
All right.
That song, I mean, The Power by
Do
Snap.
Do you have The Power?
I've got The Power, sir. Do you remember Snap, the group Snap?
Of course. I remember that damn song.
Of course you do. And do you relate that song to the movie every time you hear it?
Yeah. Yes. If not for the fact that song wasn't also everywhere.
Yeah, it was. That was a huge song.
Escape. I mean, especially just that that beginning. I've got the power. You know, it was just, oh, God. Everywhere.
It's a German music group. They go by the name of Snap, with the exclamation point at the end there, because if you couldn't tell, she screams, I've got the power, and they screeched their choruses typically. It was released in 1990, and it hit number 2 on the Hot 100 charts behind Mariah Carey's Vision of Love. So it was a big hit here in the States, and really, that I always put that opening sequence with Speakman doing his thing in the apartment to the song. It always kind of just was a great entryway to this movie. I mean, Seagal had that great entry in Above the Law. Van Damme doesn't have particularly a great entry in Bloodsport, but this was a great way to introduce a new action hero, I thought.
Yeah, it definitely is the highlight of the film, because so much is unrealized at this point, and there's so much potential just watching the scene, thinking, oh my God, this is going to be a great movie. And I don't know, it's kind of a double-edged sword for this script, story, and movie, where the simplicity is something that I just absolutely love about these types of movies. And this thing has it in spades, and it doesn't really try to overcomplicate anything. But at the same time, it's so simplistic, it almost just not necessarily loses its way, but just loses momentum at times.
It's so thin, it becomes almost, it vaporizes as you're watching it, I realized. Mm-hmm. About an hour into this, I thought, oh wow, like this is so just a thin movie story. It's Fistful of Dollars, it's Yojimbo before that, it's all these things where the outsider comes to town and gets involved in a power struggle between two warring factions, and he can make a difference because he doesn't have an allegiance.
But you have to love the whole guy in training that doesn't complete his training, so doesn't quite understand it stuff. Oh, yeah, and then by the end of it, he's going to earn the knowledge that he has to go back and master it, you know, to completely understand it in some sense, even though he's clearly completely mastered it. I don't know what he hasn't really, right?
Well, that's one of the tropes of these martial art films that I actually like that it continues, is that these guys aren't really totally matured beings at that point. Even the end of Bloodsport, Van Damme gets, you know, the ceremonial ribbon and he can graduate now because he's achieved something. Bruce Leroy got the glow. And now Jeff Speakman, he gets the tiger and the dragon.
No, he gets the power. Upside down.
He's had the power.
He already has the power. Yeah.
I got two things to point out. One, if somebody above me in an apartment building was doing that kind of activity, I would be pissed, especially blaring that music that hour of night. Two, is he on a chain gang as the movie starts? What is his lot in life? Did you pick that up when he goes, "Hey, Sanders, time to take a power break or water break"?
I don't know.
Like shoveling dirt on some roadside chain gang? Like what? Is he still paying for beating that kid's ass in high school?
I mean, possibly that's what that was. I don't know because I don't think they really did such a or paid much attention to a lot of detail on this, but he's definitely still in his own mind paying for that, right? So maybe it was volunteer work.
Maybe he's like shutting himself. He's like doing very monkish things.
Yeah.
It's his version of going to a monastery like in
Rainbow.
Well,
that is what he learned, right? When he accidentally killed, killed that kid or whatever.
Almost kills the kid, right? He doesn't
actually kill him though, right? I mean, they take him off, right? To the hospital. I can't remember now.
Trevor's talking about here in the flashback sequence when Jeff Speakman's character is driving into Los Angeles, or he's driving out of Los Angeles. Where does this movie take place exactly? I can't recall. Is it San Francisco? I know he's driving somewhere in LA. To get somewhere else is all I can really remember. Yeah. And he's in that, he looks like the Marlboro man there with his 5 o'clock shadow. And
it takes place in some nondescript city on the shore.
It takes place in the Paramount backlot is where it takes place. Regardless here, he's in his car and he's thinking back on the things that has impacted his life thus far. And he got into a little squabble with the boys on the football team and put an ass whooping on one of them. And he's now racked with guilt.
Like broke the kid's back or whatever, right? I mean, I thought he killed him.
It's been at least a decade,
but
right?
I guess not. Yeah.
He's got to be in his late 20s, early 30s in this movie.
Oh, apparently. Easily.
So he's given himself a hard time for a decade over this bit of foolishness as a teenager. And he's still beating himself up as he goes to this town. And on the flashback, they never really specify, though. I thought he was justified in kicking the shit out of the guy. What do you think?
Yes, but he did it without having completed his training, so he wasn't fully able to control his strength. You see, the power that he has. And so he damaged that kid, and so it kind of scared him off, right? And so he didn't complete his training at all then. And now he's kind of reserved, and he's still the martial arts guy, but he's not wanting to necessarily get involved in stuff, right? Isn't that kind of the idea, I thought, anyways? I know, kind of like a Con Air thing, right? Where he killed the people accidentally, but he's not a bad person, right?
Watch. I mean, he obviously is quick to jump into some shit when he gets to town and he pulls the guy out the window. He's not...
I've already said this movie does not handle detail very well. All right. I'm just saying what the beginning sets up is that right.
I like the beginning setup though. I like that dynamic.
I love it too. It just doesn't pan out to be anything.
No, because he's got the little brother character who he was sticking up for as he beats up the football player, which gets him ostracized from the
family.
Which
becomes Rufio later on in the movie. Right.
in a sense, I guess. Yeah. I never thought that's what Rufio is. I never got that family issue on it, but I like what you did because that Adam character as a cop is such a weenie of a character. He's constantly being smacked around in this flick. I mean, Jeff Speakman open hand bitch slaps him at least twice, and the same thing the football player gets away with on his brother and gets the shit kicked out of him. Speakman's doing freely to his own little brother. So like he saw that he was a cop. You know what I'm saying? He like slapped him at least two or three times. I mean, that's what got you in this problem. Yeah. It's a useless role for that actor. But my problem here when he goes into town and he goes into Yun's shop and these kind of things, and it's the beating up the, you know, the old guys, getting the shop kicked around, and he comes in and does twice as much damage, but it's okay because he's saving the day, you know, this bull in a China
shop.
Since
you're saying young, you gotta love James Hong, though.
He's great in this.
He's fantastic in every single thing he's ever been in. And for those of you who don't know him, you recognize him immediately if you ever see him. But I don't know. He's in so much stuff. I'm sure
also,
people.
Also, Mako is in this, who was, you know, obviously in Conan.
One of the bad guys.
Then you have Oddjob. I can't think of his name, but from the James Bond films. So they do have a cast here of Asian actors that have some sort of.
Where is Mako one of the bad guys? I can't remember now how the story ends. He's the guy that gets killed, right?
Yeah, he's his buddy. He's his, the dad's
That's
friend.
That's
One of my favorite lines, too, is when Mako in the flashback sequences suggests to the father that maybe Jeff should go to this new school that teaches honor and respect. The dad goes, schools, is it? He just immediately, like, just think, what are they doing, drugs over there, fucking hippies? So they'd be like, you vegans, you guys eating the cheese over there or what? What are you doing?
Oh, God.
I'm with you. But the production here goes so flat, and all the sets are so flatly lit from this
point on.
Oh,
God, it gets bad, yeah.
When he walks by his old karate studio and walks across the street, and you're like, oh, there's three people that exist in this world. The two people in the karate studio and him on the street.
Oh, yeah. It's very selectively framed throughout the middle of it, you know, especially inside cars. I mean, you can tell that the car is just parked somewhere, anywhere, who knows where. When they're walking down sidewalks and things, they just frame it so that you can't probably see the set across the way, you know?
Yeah, it's delicately framed. You put that right. Do you think that this technically, you know, in terms of like filmmaking, is a better film than Bloodsport from a technical aspect of lighting, money spent on it? You don't think they just – because I've always heard that they salvaged Bloodsport out of nothing. You know, with the editing, Van Damme and Sheldon Lettage made something out of nothing. But then again, you have to film something.
Maybe that's true. I don't know. I mean, editing surely is not also a – strength of the perfect weapon. I don't know. I mean, whether they salvage it or not, the movies are at best lit and shot the same, I guess. I mean, Bloodsport's framed and choreographed way better, direction wise, you know, blocking and everything. This movie is practically a zero for the most part on all of it, which is why I say the beginning scene, clearly some time was spent on that, and someone was actually, you know, writing a script, like, this is this guy's backstory, this is everything. And then once you get out of that, they just went, and there's the rest of the movie.
Well, what it does is delivers a fight scene about every 5 minutes or so after a certain amount of time here.
Yeah, it's not very good, though.
You know, but it does continue that 1980s and 1990s tradition of our hero beating up a gang of would-be muggers.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
That was a big trope for a while.
I mean, the bad guys are clearly bad guys until he makes a mistake, and then they're not. But they rectify that immediately, right? This is definitely one of those simple movies where bad is bad, good is good.
Yeah, everybody wears a black hat or a white hat. And my favorite is the first kill by Oddjob, because I don't remember his name in this movie. It's like Tetsuro or some shit, but I'm going to call him Oddjob for just sake of ease. That I love that his first victim, he basically bear hugs him and then headbutts him and then leaves this nice little dandelion on his lapel. And what kind of – I mean, first of all, you're incriminating yourself wherever you go. And I just thought like that was a weak –
But this is before CSI, Jason, before CSI.
That's true. And that is true.
You couldn't catch anybody. Yeah, you had no idea what was going on.
I mean, they bust out the folders of mugshots to give Jeff Speakman. Can you see him there, Jeff? No, I see him out of 40 pictures. Sorry, we can't get the killer. Yeah, so there's a reason I guess this isn't too fondly remembered. My favorite scene in this entire movie is when he goes to the dojo. And he does the, I bet I could kick your ass, but not you. I bet all three of you. I love that sequence, even though the sound effects are pumped up to an absurd level.
Yes.
He's hitting and chopping, and it is literally an M16 going off in a Rambo movie. I love that sequence, though. To me, that's this movie.
I miss
the beginning part.
I miss meaty punches and stuff like that. The sound effects of the late 80s and early 90s for a punch, you know?
Yeah, the wallop is what I call it. You know, it's a fucking wallop.
I mean, if anyone punched someone, you heard that sound, that person's dead.
I mean, I remember when I was a, I remember in, as a kid, and I, you know, grew up on Rocky and Indiana Jones and all this, and like the sound of a punch was like swashbuckling. And yeah. I remember being like a fairly young kid and seeing some older kids getting a squabble on the block, and one of them sucked, the other one I thought dead. But the deadening sound of a knuckle hitting flesh was so – it was just dead. It was so not the sound I expected to come out of that. That it was a harsh realization that, that Indiana Jones is bullshit, you know, that that kind of like wah-wah, wah-bash, you know. It's like – and Rocky is a shock at blast when he hits people. So it was a harsh reality to live with. But moving on, I do think that is the best sequence in the film that is really light otherwise. And – that really, to me, the end sequence is so small and short and too quick, it's just really
quick to wrap up.
It's unspectacular, and a lot of it, the whole movie's quick to wrap up. You brought up the point where we were misguided for maybe one scene into who the bad guy is, and then we realize in that very next sequence, because even the character says something, the man breaks in my house to kill me, and now he leaves my blessing and my loved one. Strange. No, bad writing is what I want to say.
What's just, you know, crap happens, right? I mean, this guy just walks around and he just kind of does almost zero detective work. I love when the scene where they're hiding in the car and they're following the guy.
Oh, is that like when they're in the drop in the, ATM? In the
yes. The guy goes to the bank.
We're going to follow him on an ATM drop? That's a bad idea.
And they're like a car length away from him. They're like, get down. It's like, why would your car be there anyways? With no one in it.
What you're doing?
What is going on? Yeah, and it's no wonder the guy spots them. Like, what the hell?
How could he not? When they use the, you know, the you can't go wrong hole in the newspaper. Yeah. That was not a very good idea at the time. It felt like, what are we gonna do today? Okay, well, you're gonna pull up and you're gonna look through, and we also got to give. I want to give a shout out to Kiri Hiruka Tagawa, who was in Mortal Kombat, who was in this movie as well, we haven't talked about. And Bo Starr, Jeff Bridges' brother, shows up in this movie as well. I take that back. He does not. I'm confusing this with a different martial arts film called Sidekicks. Thank you. I was like, wait a minute.
You just said Bo Starr. You just said Starr.
Yeah. Well, Bo Starr
that would be Bo Bridges. Would be Jeff Bridges' brother.
Exactly. Bo Starr is one of those actors you've seen your whole life in movies, and you're like, who is that? And that's that guy. I like that guy. He was the dad in this. He was in Halloween 4 and 5. He's been in a shitload of movies. But Dante Bosco is, young Jimmy Ho in this, and Rufio for the public in. He's actually a Bay Area guy from Pittsburgh, California, which is not too far from where I'm at broadcasting right now. So,
Working?
He is still working, but I think he's not.
Really?
No, he is. He's got – I'm on his IMDb page right now. He does voiceover work for Star Wars Rebels.
What was his last movie? Jarhead 3?
Yeah, he was. I saw that and reviewed it for the site, and he was the videographer in that film.
He wasn't Take the Lead. That's right.
Yeah, I mean, great. You saw Take the Lead, huh? I saw Jarhead 3. You saw Take the Lead?
Take the Lead's a good movie. That's Antonio Banderas. You shut
up. Okay, I thought it was a Bring It On.
Shut your mouth.
I did see Take the Lead as well.
Yeah, thank you.
But he has 2 movies completed, it looks like, 3 in pre-production and 1 filming currently. So he is still working out there, and it's got to be strange to forever be known for Rufio. Although if I see him ever,
right
I
at the
swear
beginning
God,
of his career.
I'm going to yell out, Jimmy Ho! And see if he gets there. Sure, he'd be like, what in the fuck is that guy?
He won't.
He'll probably think I'm Jeff Speakman. He's like, well, how do you know Speakman?
He will not know what you're talking about.
I like that his full name. Check this out. I mean, Rufio's full name. This should be a fucking trivia question, one of those bar things. Is Dante Roman Titus Bosco.
Wow. Quite the
name. Got a little Italian in your blood there, bud? I like that name. Let's take a quick break and listen to the TV spot, the 30-second TV spot for the trailer of this film.
A tragedy he could not prevent.
Kim!
Leads him into a forbidden world.
Who killed Kim?
He has no gun. No fear. No equal.
No problem.
Jeff Speakman is the perfect weapon. Rated R. Starts Friday, March 15th at theaters everywhere.
Hey, that's coming up.
It is. I would definitely go to the theater and see that. Would you see this on a retro if they had a retro screening of this, like at the Lemley or something like that, or somewhere close?
Not anymore.
I know, right? I guess they don't do that anymore. New Beverly?
No, I mean, I just saw it. I don't want to see it again. I don't think I would want to see this in a theater right now. Had I not recently seen this, yes, I'd be there. I mean, I'd go see Street Night, so I haven't seen that in a while. But you have to admit that trailers like this get you a little pumped up, don't they?
Well, Don LaFontaine with that beautiful voice of his, that in the world of, you know, that it just, to me, it's so bigger than life. All of this was bigger than life. Maybe I was, you know, a younger kid and a little bit more open-eyed when it came to this kind of stuff, but I feel like
I'd still love it. If they played a trailer like that today, I'd be like, yes, I'm seeing that.
If the next Jason Statham movie came out with a trailer like that, you still would be like, I don't know.
No, if it was a trailer like this, I'd go see it.
They can't break anybody like this nowadays. They wouldn't be able to do this. Pull someone you've never heard of and say, hey, this guy, now they have to have an angle. It's got to be a UFC fighter. It's got to be a professional a WWF guy. They would never be able to say, hey, this guy's been kicking ass over here in some random situation, or this guy does X, Y, and Z. He's a badass. We're putting all this money behind him. It would tank. I mean, they couldn't get away with it basically in 91, so they're sure as hell not going to do it in 18. And Disney has no interest.
But I want it.
Yeah, I know. I agree. This happens on occasion in the B movie market, and since I still follow the B movie action market,
it still happens not only on occasion, but it happens in Hollywood, right? I mean, think about Chris Pratt. Think about what's his name from The Office, Jim. What's that guy's name?
Krasinski.
John
Krasinski. Whatever that guy's name is. Yeah.
John Krasinski. Yeah, he's basically an action star now, or slowly becoming one. So I don't know. It does come from weird places.
Both those guys were not known for being comedic or action heroes. It was comedic and
exactly.
Comedic.
Yeah.
So they went the Keanu Reeves, Nicolas Cage route, which they took their career into the action realm in a way where this guy was broke as an action star and really stuck in that because as you can see,
but he was a martial artist, right?
But he was also a professionally trained actor. He'd been on soap operas, romantic dramas.
Really? I have no idea.
He was on General Hospital, so he was.
I can see him
guys,
as a soap actor
for sure. He has that look, you know.
Yeah.
And I just think that he was the most classically trained, and it's a shame he didn't get a chance to really display what he could do. If you're interested, you know, this is streaming right now on Amazon Prime. I watched a Blu-ray of this. I own the Blu-ray, but Olive Films released one recently, and it looks just as good as on Amazon. So. I suggest you look that. But they have a lot of other Speakman films on there, and I would suggest if you have the time to check out Land of the Free, which is one he did with William Shatner, and also Running Red. Those are some of the better ones he did afterwards. Also, Deadly Outbreak with Ron Silver is kind of a fun Die Hard-esque movie. So he did some fun movies after this, but they never were on the level of competence, I guess, that this is. And I mean, because this does have the competence that a lot of B movies don't. They aren't blessed with because it did have a movie. You look at films from like Mark Dacascos and things like this. This is much better than Only the Strong, which was also his, you know, movie that they tried to push Dacascos, which didn't take. I mean, right? Because this is a better movie than that.
No, you're right. I mean, there are plenty of actors just like Speakman around this time that didn't make it. I mean, we listed, or obviously we don't have to list who did make it. Everyone knows them.
Yeah,
but there were a lot that they did try. But it was so, I think one of the issues that existed back then that doesn't exist now is that VHS market, you know?
Yeah, it was definitely this had to over-index on the VHS market. It had to, because this was constantly on HBO. I mean, this was rented amongst my friends numerous times. I mean, just watching this.
Well, these types of movies rented super well.
Oh, shit, man, we'd have sleepovers, and it would be Silent Night, Deadly Night, and American Ninja. You know what I mean? And those were rented from the local video store.
Right.
And I'm sure we rented those numerous times. And if your box art was even slightly decent, we would get there. Well, I'm pretty happy that we went back and looked at this, but at the same time, I'm a little sad because it doesn't have the same oomph that it had when I was 12.
Yeah, this is one of those ones that I'm going to have to forget about in another decade and before I revisit.
Yeah, it's going to take me at least another 10 years to get back to watching this. Yeah. And I still own my VHS copy of this from when I was a kid and
will
the Blu-ray, so
even,
I can't give up the Blu-ray.
Yeah, will you even be able to find this movie in 10 years?
Only on YouTube. I think this is actually available in its entirety on YouTube as well.
As, I wouldn't doubt it. Not worth protecting the copyright.
As Amazon. When you went to find this on Amazon, did the box art pop up? Because it's like the only thing out of all my streaming things that didn't have a cover art. And the cover art's great.
Yeah, you know, there's a there were two, as is normal with weird stuff like this on Amazon, there were two separate versions of this. One just for sale, or one on a subscription service, I guess. And one of the subscription services must have this available. Which I'm not sure. I don't think that had that. There was something weird about it. I don't know. One had box art, one didn't.
Huh.
And I can't remember if it was the Prime one or the one that was on the some the other service was offering it. You know,
mine didn't have anything on the Prime. But regardless, check out the poster art of this if you get a chance. It's probably the best thing about the movie, which is what we said about Beastmaster last week. But we'll be back with you guys next week with an all-new episode of the Movie Mavericks podcast. Speaking for Trevor Anderson, I'm Jason Rugard, and we are the Movie Mavericks.
Oh my, another magnificent episode has come to an end. If you're craving more, set your destination to MovieMavericks.com, Warp 9. Engage!